TED Audio Collective.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Design Matters is on summer break, but we thought it was a good time to repost some of our favorite episodes. This one was originally posted in March of 2016. This is Design Matters with Debbie Millman from DesignObserver.com. For 11 years now, Debbie Millman has been talking with designers and other creative types about what they do, how they got to be who they are, and what they're thinking about. On this podcast, Debbie Millman talks with writer and illustrator Myra Kalman about how ordinary objects inspire her art and about her collaborations with the likes of Mark Morris and Isaac Mizrahi.
If things are going well, there's a lot of trust. If you have to talk too much about something, I think that you might be in a little bit of trouble.
Here's Debbie Millman.
Myra Kalman has authored and illustrated some of the most remarkable books of our time, including The Principles of Uncertainty and The Pursuit of Happiness. Her work has appeared on countless covers of The New Yorker, in museums, and on the stage. Today, I'm going to talk with Myra Kalman about her latest book, Beloved Dog, and about the twists and turns of her remarkable life and career. Myra Kalman, welcome to Design Matters.
Hi, Debbie. Good to be here.
We haven't had a Design Matters interview now in 10 years.
That's amazing.
You were on
my
very...
It feels like a minute ago.
Doesn't it? I want to congratulate you on winning the AIGA medal. So well deserved.
Thank you.
And I want to start by talking a little bit about your upbringing. Your parents left Russia to go to Palestine, and you were born in Tel Aviv. Your family moved to New York when you were 4 years old. Do you have any memories of what it was like to live in Tel Aviv when you were a very little girl?
I have such vivid memories that they're probably more real to me than what's going on right now, which tells you something about a life. But we went back in the summers, and we still have an apartment there, so those memories have become my daily life. But it was an incredible time of beautiful sand and sea and cafes with fluttering awnings and music. People coming from all over the world, tango playing in the restaurants, and quite beautiful ice cream cups with little crackers in them.
I've spent a lot of time in Israel, and I think the food in Israel is better than almost any place on the planet, aside from maybe Italy.
That's true. That's true. It's a super amazing food place.
You said that when you moved to New York, you felt like an outsider. Why? And did that feeling ever go away?
Well, I felt like an outsider in the best sense of the word. I loved it. It wasn't as if I was unhappy. But I guess I became a journalist when I was 5 years old, and I was really very keen about observing and just looking and taking it all in. And thinking that it was all fantastic, I went from this sandy little town to this gigantic city. I felt comfortable, but I felt, I better observe a bit.
In an interview on The Great Discontent, you spoke about how your mother, Sarah, encouraged your creative life and how she took you to concerts and operas, to the library, and how you sat together and read. Were you close your whole life?
Yes, I was madly in love with her, as she was with me. So we had this fantastic bond, and it never stopped.
You stated that though she wasn't an artist, she was a homemaker. She was quite gorgeous and amazing and interesting. And for you, she was very much a model of a person who had great integrity, honesty, and said what she thought and taught you there was no right way to think about things. In reviewing that description, Myra, I felt that it sounded how I would describe you.
That's good. That would be a great thing to be able to say. Though she wasn't capable of lying, and I can actually lie. So there are some differences, besides the fact that she was gorgeous. But I think I really did absorb a lot of her persona, and it serves me well, I think. I'm happy about that.
And do you have siblings?
I do. I have an older sister.
And is she like your mother as well? Are you very similar?
She loves my mother, too. Maybe I'm a little bit more extreme in my adoration.
You also said that your mother had no real need to have any information of any kind about anything. And I think that her map of the United States, which you include in your book, The Principles of Uncertainty, is a really wonderful example of this. In the center of the map is a great blob of American landscape in which she wrote, "Sorry, the rest is unknown. Thank you." And you've stated that you take that to mean the rest is unknown. Who cares? Go to hell. How did that map influence you?
Well, it's the absolute expression of a person who really is so irreverent and has a great sense of humor, but also is doing it naturally, not trying to be funny, not trying to be coy. And so, you know, not getting it right, but just getting it the way that you need to get it is really the point of it all.
And so everything was acceptable.
And
artistic.
Yeah. You know, that sense of the unconditional love that you were talking about before absolutely came through. And also the sense of you should daydream because that's the right thing to do. No worries. You know, read a lot. Play your piano.
Myra, do you have any sense of how rare that is?
I hear that from people, but I can't imagine how else it would be.
Your father was a diamond salesman, and he traveled a great deal for his work. So you were raised in a house of women, your mother, your aunt, your sister, and you. And you stated that your encouragement came not from being told to try any specific thing, but from being loved and told that whatever you did was great. Did you really have the sense, or do you still, and if you did, do you still have the sense that what you do is great?
No, I think that what I do is terrible. I'm constantly tormented. And that's, I mean, but I think that's the nature of creating anything, that if you don't have doubts, then there's something wrong with you if you don't have doubts. So there is the duality that you have tremendous insecurity and a tremendous need and a drive to do the work despite that or because of that. I don't know. So I am always worried and always waking up in the middle of the night wondering how I could have done it better and next time I will do it better. And that kind of propels me into being very excited and almost hysterical about any project I do.
Hysterical in a good way?
No, in a terrible way.
No.
But again, I don't, you know, I've come to the point where I think that the nature of worrying or doubting or you know, fretting is part of the process.
You romanticize it in such a way that worrying and fretting almost feels totally acceptable and even more than okay. It feels almost aspirational.
You know, I'm in a good mood today, so it sounds like fun, but it's
not.
No,
but I mean, even just from reading all your work and experiencing the sort of beautiful pathos of knowing that there's a part of us that's all a little bit broken or a little bit askew or a little bit or maybe a lot imperfect. Somehow reading your work and being involved in your world somehow makes it feel all okay. It's almost like what your mother was doing for you with the unconditional love you do for your readers in that you allow them to feel okay in the world as is. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. What choice do we have? But thank you.
You attended the High School of Music and Art, which is now the LaGuardia High School of Music and Art and Performing Arts.
Yeah.
You studied music.
Right.
You also had piano lessons and dance lessons when you were growing up. At that point, did you want to be a musician?
No, I knew I wasn't very good. I was good enough to get into music and art, so some proficiency and some feeling, but absolutely not. Once I got there and I saw what real musicians were like, I said, well, that's not going to happen. But I never thought that would happen anyway. It was just, I adore music, and I still, that's really an important part of my life and part of my work that's happening now, but I would never be a musician.
What instruments did you play when you were growing up?
I played the violin and the piano.
So you did play the violin. When I saw your Elements of Style opera, you seemed to be playing a violin proficiently. And I remember thinking, my God, is there anything this woman cannot do?
Well, and I cannot play the violin anymore. I was pretending, but I knew how to pretend.
When did you decide that you wanted to be an artist and a writer?
I had decided that I wanted to be a writer when I was a little kid, when I read, was reading so much, and I read Pippi Longstocking, and I said, that's it. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write books, and I'm going to be a strong and wonderful girl. That disappears quickly when you go into your adolescence, and then everything is very shaky. But I knew that I wanted to be a writer. When I was writing in high school and college, and everything seemed turgid. Or is it turgid?
Turgid.
Clearly, I wasn't that good with my words. So at any rate, I decided that I couldn't write anymore, and it would be quite easy and delightful to draw my stories. And it was, Saul Steinberg was a big influence, and there was a real something in the air about I can do this in another way, and I don't have to write.
What was it about Pippi that you liked so much?
Well, the writing is fantastic. Astrid Lindgren is sublime. And just that there is a heroine who is a brave, independent, saucy, feisty, fearless girl. I mean, who wouldn't love that?
Did you do your hair like her in the
no,
braids?
No, but we did that for Lulu.
I put wire in my braids to
That's
have
what we
hair
did for
like
her.
Pippi.
Yeah.
Yeah. You attended New York University in the late 60s, and that is where you met the man who would become your husband, Tibor Kalman. Tell me about your first meeting. Was it love at first sight?
Well, I think for him it was, but we were in summer flunk-out class in economics, and we were both on the verge of being thrown out of school after our first year of doing very badly, or not really caring. And he asked me to go out for a cup of coffee. So we went to Washington Square Park, and he drank black coffee and smoked a cigarette. I don't think he had done either yet, but I think he was trying to impress me. And I thought, well, this is okay. What happened was that we knew immediately that we had found each other.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, we broke up a few times after that. It's not as if it stayed. But
you actually have told me you broke up three times.
Yeah, that's true.
Why were you in a flunk-out class for economics? I can't understand why.
Well, we had to do our basic things. I mean, we had other classes that we had flunked out of, but we met in the economics class.
So you dropped out of NYU.
Yes, we both dropped out of NYU.
Was it because of academic reasons, or was it because you just lost interest in that type of education?
I spent most of my time in cafes writing bad poetry and knitting sweaters for Tibor, as I've written. And he was trying to, blow up the math building. It was, Vietnam and SDS, and the sense of that there were so many other things to be doing besides going to school. So it didn't compel me in a way that I was motivated, and he certainly was, ready to go to the barricades. And then he went to Cuba with the Venceremos Brigade. So it's a little bit fuzzy exactly what happened, but also, the sense of feminism exploding in the air in those days. So there was so much going on. School seemed like the least important thing to us.
Do you ever regret dropping out?
No, not at all.
In your official bio, it said that in 1979, Tibor started M & Company, but didn't you start it together?
No, he started it with two partners.
Well, Carol Bocanowicz, yeah,
and Liz Trovato, who were friends and who he had met at Barnes & Noble when he was the creative director. And I was always there as a kind of, there with him, clearly, as a kind of muse, as a kind of...
We are the M and M & Company, Myra.
So I'm going to take that, right, I'm going to take that as a real thing. And that sense that I was doing other things, I started to illustrate, and I would always be around part of the time. So, and the dialogue that we had constantly was about work and about all of that creativity. So, I know that I was a big influence and a big presence there, but I wasn't official.
You've stated that historically, M & Company was in the right place at the right time. There was an audience for the kind of work we wanted to do, and there was the ability to make it happen. And I felt like M & Company has been so influential in so many ways, not only culturally, not only in the community of graphic design, but in the great number of people that have come out of M & Company to then go on and create remarkable work. People like Emily Oberman, Alex Isley, Stephen Doyle. I mean, the list goes on and on. Stefan Sagmeister. It feels a little bit more than the right place at the right time. That feels a little bit too serendipitous.
Well, you know, Tibor was an absolute genius. And to me, the constant inventiveness, the constant thrill of how his mind worked was just, you know, just exhilarating in every way. And you know, when you ask about the determination to do a project through the worries, I mean, for me, it was the Tibor factor. I really understood and learned what it meant to be with somebody who was not daunted, who said, if you have an idea, that's fine, but you better do something about it. Otherwise, what's the point? And so that, to me, became the natural part of our life. And his very demanding, incredibly strong personality, when he was in the room, there was nobody else in the room. I mean, there was a lot of Tibor to contend with, but it was extraordinary, and there was nobody like him.
In the mid-1980s, you published your first children's book, Stay Up Late, illustrating the lyrics from a song by musician David Byrne, whom you met when he hired Tibor and M & Company to design his album covers for Talking Heads. What was it like working with David Byrne at that time? I mean, that was really in the moment for Talking Heads as well.
No, it was very heady. But, you know, it was like super gawky time, super like nobody could really talk to anybody because everybody was incredibly eccentric and kind of socially inept. We were all socially inept. So we'd go out to dinner. I don't think anybody spoke to anybody. But I had complete freedom to do whatever I wanted. And that was the atmosphere also, that the point is that you should be inventive. And the point is that you should say whatever you're thinking about. And through that editing process, you come up with the best ideas, hopefully.
At the beginning of the interview, you said that you became a journalist at age 5. And though you've illustrated and written dozens of books since, you've said that the title of artist actually makes you uncomfortable. You much prefer and embrace the title of journalist. Why is that?
Well, you know, it's a kind of cliche to think that the artist goes into a studio and has to come up with something. That's really not how I work. I like to have the connection of an assignment. I like to have the connection of people around me and or waiting for something, and that there is a kind of a construct to what I'm doing. And so as a journalist, I really do feel that my job is, if I'm working for The Times or for The New Yorker, go out and look at something and then send back your report, the painting and the writing. So it's very clear to me that that's something that I really adore doing.
Tibor died of cancer in 1999, and in your most recent book, Beloved Dog, you state, when Tibor died, the world came to an end, and the world did not come to an end. That is something you learn. I first read that while going through some truly what felt like a bottomless pit of grief at loss that I'd experienced, and it gave me great comfort. But I can't imagine coming up with that thought to begin with. How did you learn that, Myra?
You know, when he was ill, and he was ill for 5 years, and so the process of that was devastating. But through it all, we had, you know, 2 children, and we kept working and taking care of the family. I was sure that I wouldn't be able to survive when he died. I was sure that it was really be over for me, and somehow the years would continue. And then in some crazy kind of, you know, way that I don't understand, I felt like I had taken on his courage and worked with a force and a fierceness that I hadn't had before. I mean, of course, you understand that time is short and that to make the most of your time. But I was able to. And I also had, you know, when you have children, you have to rally.
In a 2003 interview in I Magazine with the great Stephen Heller, you stated, even though feminism burst into being one rainy night, 1969, Tibor and I still had a conventional relationship in the sense that I was in the background. I was insecure about dealing forcefully with the outside world. What made me come to the fore was Tibor's death. Maybe I had learned more than I knew from Tibor, and maybe I realized that life is short, so why not do whatever you can think of that excites you? There's probably a myth about a woman not being able to really thrive without a man after a lifelong relationship. But people are incredibly resourceful. There are kids and friends and ideas and traveling to China. You know, life. When did you stop being insecure and felt more courageous about dealing with the outside world? Was it immediate, or was it just sort of a growing sense that you had something that you wanted to express?
It was absolutely immediate, which startled me, really startled me. I mean, I've always been forthright in what I think. I've never been shy to say what my opinion is. But right away, I said, I'm going to do what I need to do here.
You've said it took a long time to become an illustrator. And in order to actually become a working illustrator, you talked to as many people as you could and would just ask them, would you like to hire me to do a magazine piece? Really? Is that how you did it?
No, I had a portfolio. I wasn't just stopping people on the street.
Excuse me.
Anybody. Well, anybody. But, you know, the sense that you, in back in the day, with the portfolio and drop it off and expect a million rejections and get them. And, you know, in some file, I have all my rejection slips from the New York or another place is saying, you know, good job or not good job, just, you know, get out of here. But, you know, I don't know why I had this kind of optimism that carried through that, no, I'm going to pursue this. So, it takes a while to do anything.
So you got rejected several times from The New Yorker before you got your first commission from
The
New Yorker.
Oh, many times, yeah.
So you just submitted your portfolio or did you submit actual work for them specifically?
Both. Yeah, I would do drawings that I thought would be sensational covers and not quite. It was only when we were living in Rome in, you know, 30, whatever it was, 25 years after I started that Françoise Moulic got in touch and said, would you like to do a cover? So she had seen enough of my work in different places, of course, and said, I think you could do this.
Talk about the Misery Parade, one of my all-time favorite
covers. I was
just
looking at the Misery Day Parade. That was an early cover for The New Yorker. And, you know, you go to look at parades and everybody seems so chipper and super dandy and ducky and you think, really? And so why don't we have a parade to show what we really feel like? And, of course, February is this dismal month. So it was a perfect parade, you know, like the Paralyzed by Panic Brigade.
And right.
Stuff
I mean,
like that.
This is exactly what I mean about somehow making it absolutely okay to be part of the Misery Brigade.
Right.
You know, you just feel somehow this solidarity with the human race in looking at your work.
Well, who isn't miserable? I
mean, you know, exactly. Let's talk a little bit about your collaborations. I'd like to name people that you've collaborated with, and I'd love it if you could share what it was like or an anecdote or just a word or an idea. So first, of course, our wonderful Isaac Mizrahi, with whom you've designed fabric for. You also appeared as a duck in his production of Peter and the Wolf at the Guggenheim, wherein you wore tutu and flippers. So talk about your relationship and your work with Isaac.
He's a dear and darling friend and man and human being in the greatest sense of the word, and has such capacity for generosity of spirit. So, and very funny, of course. So, you know, from the minute we met, we fell in love, and now we're neighbors. And so if he needs a duck, you know, he knows who to call.
He told me that he has what he believes is the largest Myra Kelman collection in the world.
I think probably he has a lot of paintings.
Okay. Mark Morris, with whom you've designed sets for his ballets.
Mark Morris is another genius. I tremble before him. He's a formidable person. So, you know, he asked me to do a project once, and I said yes, of course. He said, you know, you don't have to answer yes. You're allowed to say no. And I thought, it's very kind of him to say that, but he'd probably kill me if I said no. So we've had a great time. Also, that sense of being able to do what you want to do with people who are smart and funny and strange, hurrah.
You worked on an opera for The Elements of Style with Nico Muhly, and then again on a piece for The Principles of Uncertainty. And in working with Nico, you stated that entering into that world and not knowing what the outcome would be was a big risk. Yet you did it anyway. And you met Nico, I think, when he was, what, 12?
Yeah. Nico and I, we were in Rome, and he was 12, and I was older. And he became part of the family. You know, he was my kid's age. So there was this fantastic connection. He and his mother were at the American Academy. She's a painter, Bunny Harvey. And so we just became friends, and he would play the piano, and I would sing. I can't believe how I would torture him with those kind of afternoons.
What kinds of things did you sing?
Like Italian love songs.
Oh, how marvelous!
Yes. So, and then when he was older and came to Columbia, he worked for M & Company, and then he worked for me. So, the connection was always there.
And so, how did you go about collaborating with him on an opera when you had never done something like that before? How do you start collaborating when you don't even know what that means?
Well, Nico does the composing. I was like, we had separate tasks. So I had a few desires that, you know, there were a few texts that I wanted to use and a few pieces that I wanted to have. And I also wanted to have an orchestra of percussionists who were not musicians so I could have a part in the, you know, in the show, including Isaac and Rick and my sister and a few other friends. So I said, there are a few things that I want in it, like things that I collect, like clattering teacups and saucers and typewriters. And,
wasn't there an egg beater?
Yeah, egg beaters, because there's an egg beater in the book. So all of these mundane objects that fascinate me, that I paint, that I really love, I thought that they could become a presence in this counterpoint with real musicians and real singers.
What about these objects, these instruments, did you find so fascinating?
You know, they're all designed, so if you like how they're designed, then you really love them. And of course, they tell stories and they have relationships to times of day and the thing you drink your coffee from and what are you doing when you're drinking your coffee and, you know, who are you talking to or who are you having a fight with and, you know, what shoes are you going to wear then? You know, it's all the same thing.
You also collaborated with Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket, and Michael Pollan, illustrating their books. Is there a different approach you take when you're illustrating somebody else's words, or is it very similar to when you're illustrating your own words?
Well, I'm a little bereft that I've given up part of the control of the book, so I'm incredibly polite, but maybe a little bit sad. And I'm looking at the text the way that I would if I was illustrating something for a magazine and just seeing what feels right. And then there's a back and forth about what's working and what might not be working, and of course with a wonderful editor also. If things are going well, there's a lot of trust. If you have to talk too much about something, I think that you might be in a little bit of trouble.
Can you talk a little bit about your process of painting, which I know is a gruesome question, but I really, truly am curious. Do you sketch or photograph your subjects first? How do you go about starting a painting?
I spend a lot of time wandering around, so I'm photographing a lot. And then I have books and magazines, so I'm collecting a lot of reference that's up on the wall in a scattered way. I'm not sure what's going to happen and why I've taken it, but I know I'm going to use it for something. And some things I fall so in love with that I paint them over and over again. And then I'm always sketching before I go to paint. And writing and changing it and changing it and writing many drafts before I finally say, okay, this is it. I'm ready to paint.
Myra, your work has really evolved over the years. I was actually somewhat skeptical when Isaac said he had one of the largest, if not the largest, collection of Myra Kalman in the world, because I very well may be up there too. So I have a lot of work from your early years and work that is more recent. And it feels like the colors that you've been using are a lot denser. Feels like color is a lot more important in your work. There was a lot more white earlier on.
Yeah, I'm definitely becoming more adept, perhaps, and have more depth in painting. And I'm using gouache in a thicker way, and I'm starting to use oil paints. So, you know, it's become more painterly as opposed to more naive and drawing and sketchy.
Let's talk about your columns for the New York Times, The Principles of Uncertainty, which was the first, and The Pursuit of Happiness. The Principles of Uncertainty was in 2006, and it was essentially a narrative journal of your life. Despite the fact that it really was a very poignant journal of your life, you've said, how do you know who you are? Half the time, I do not know who I am. There is not one static place. How do you stay so centered?
Well, that's a mystery.
Okay, then.
The end.
In The Pursuit of Happiness, that was a year-long exploration of American history and democracy, and you revealed that you're a big fan of President Abraham Lincoln, and even went on to write a book about Abraham Lincoln. What is it about Abraham Lincoln that you love so much?
Well, I don't think anybody could study Lincoln and not fall in love with him. He was one of the greatest humanists in the history of the world and a very brilliant man. But I think that the kindness and the intersection of kindness and intelligence is really something very interesting to look at. And he prevailed in extraordinary times. He was not soft by any means, obviously. But he had the great love of humanity, which is really something that shines through all of these decades.
Let's talk about your latest book, Beloved Dog. you did not always love dogs. In fact, your mom felt that dogs were bloodthirsty beasts gone undercover, waiting for the perfect opportunity to upend a home or lunge at the throat of an unsuspecting little girl.
That's accurate.
So all that changed when you met Pete, the Irish Wheaton Terrier that stole your heart. Pete, the color of pink champagne. Talk about meeting Pete. Why did you get Pete?
Well, we got Pete for very sad reasons, because when Tibor was ill and the kids were little, people were saying that what we needed in the house, what would help for the mood of the house, was to get a dog. And a dog would be an incredible mood elevator and a bringer of joy and fun and happiness. And it was true. But I was, I was a little bit, I was nervous at first.
How did you even allow a dog into the house if you felt that somehow he was going to upend your home and lunge at the throat of your unsuspecting little girl?
That's another mystery. You just, some things happen and all of a sudden your brain just does a swivel and you go, okay. I think the most important decisions are made without any thought at all.
Really?
So, yeah.
Do you ever regret those decisions, or do you feel like they're always good ones?
No, I think that the decisions made without thinking are thrilling. Because that's your life. That's your whole life with all of the twists and turns. And if you didn't do them, I might think like, oh, that wasn't so great. But of course I had to do that.
You love spontaneity.
I do. I like spontaneity that isn't insane. Yeah.
So Pete became your constant companion. He was your muse. Your mother even grew to love him, from what I understand. Is it true she made him platters of blintzes and schnitzel that were only for him? No one was allowed to touch them.
Yeah, it's true. It was extraordinary. And she knit him sweaters, of course, with his initial on it.
P.
Beautiful Bauhaus P. Yeah.
I read in a wonderful article in Vogue that you never consciously realized how often you were painting dogs and putting them in your stories, but it became clear to you that over the last however many years, you'd been obsessed with dogs. You've also written quite a number of books now about Pete. So talk about your relationship to dogs, your unconscious and now your conscious relationship. Why do you think they were showing up so much in your work?
Well, they're hilarious. And they're so heartrending and they're so earnest and they're so nutty that you just, as entities in our world, as we're walking around the city, I don't understand how you could not notice and obsess about all the dogs.
You stated that you and Pete were a couple and that you realized that he loved you above all others.
Well,
and
that's, that's for sure.
Children realized that he loved you above all others. And they also wondered if you loved him above all others. What do you think it is about dogs that make them so unconditionally lovable?
First of all, they don't speak. Let's start with that. They don't speak. That's really big. If you were with somebody who didn't speak, you'd probably like them all the time. I know, I don't know. You know what I'm saying. So, everybody talks too much and gives their opinion and needs support and needs encouragement. And dogs don't need any of that. So you don't have to give them anything, which is, an incredibly selfish thing for people to do. But you don't have to give them anything except your presence.
And plates of schnitzel.
And some schnitzels, feed them. But the expectation is really just be who you are and I love you. What more do you need?
You are working on an illustrated edition of the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas. Talk about that. Can you tell us a bit about it?
I wish I had to leave right now and go to Paris, because that's what I would want to do. I just, I adore her and I adore Alice B. Toklas. I just think Gertrude and Alice were sensational in their, extreme and eccentricities and just the life that they lived. So I do want to travel to the south of France where they lived and go to visit their apartment, which I think I'm going to have access to, though, of course, it won't be the same. And just immerse myself, go to the cafe where Gertrude decided if she was going to buy that Cézanne or not. So that's, that's one of the projects that I'm working on.
And is that going to be a book of your own writing as well as, or are you using somebody else's text?
No, I'm going to use I'm just illustrating the actual text.
Oh, so the actual text, yes.
And I'll probably add an essay in the beginning or the end.
You've said that there's a fluidity between the narrative word and the narrative picture. And I'm wondering if you could elaborate and talk about in what way there is this fluidity for you.
I'm probably really influenced a lot by the Dadaists and the Futurists, who found no boundaries between language and art and text, and that the intersection of how you play with words and how you play with paintings. So, and perhaps coming from another country and learning English and just falling in love with that language and falling in love with words and letter forms. I mean, it all comes to play in a very vivid way.
Do you have favorite words?
It depends on the week or the month, but you know, sometimes I latch onto something and I don't stop saying it until people around me say, "Please stop saying that," or else I can't. I don't know what recalcitrant. I don't know what the word is this week.
Recalcitrant.
But also, you know, the names of authors, like, you know, Franz Grillparzer. I embroider that all over the place because I just can't believe that somebody has the name Grillparzer, and it makes me so happy. And there is a Grillparzer tort. So right away, all the things in my life, the cake and the name and the writer, it's all there.
Talk about Ich habe genug.
Ich habe genug.
Which is a beautiful dress hanging in the apartment of Gail Toey and Stephen Doyle. It's one of my favorite things you've ever created. Can you give us a little bit of a sense of the backstory? Because it is an embroidered dress.
Yeah, well, the Ich habe genug is a Bach cantata. And when I first heard it, I thought it's like, I've had it. I can't take it anymore. But basically it means, not basically, it means I have enough. I have enough. And it's an incredible thing to, you know, it's a wonderful thing to say, I have enough. Because then you really are centered in what you have. So I was doing a lot of embroidery and different quotes, Goethe quotes. When my mother died, I did four, these very large panels of embroidery. And the embroidery was a counterpoint to painting because it's very, very slow. And as an illustrator, you work quickly. And as an embroiderer, you work very slowly. So I was able to, you know, have the dress made and embroider on it and have this sense of this flowing thing on the wall that is not meant to be on the wall, but should be on the wall.
You mentioned the ballet you're working on. John Higginbotham is a choreographer who was a dancer with Mark Morris, and he choreographed Isaac Mizrahi's production of Peter and the Wolf, for which you danced the duck part in the tutu and the flippers. And it was a very interesting comic role, and I believe you became friends at that point. And he wanted to work with you on a ballet together, loosely based on some of Principles of Uncertainty, I believe. So I believe this is going to be coming out in 2017 at BAM.
We've been working on this, trying to create, he's obviously the choreographer, I am not, but based on it, my inspirations and work and how I'm looking at things and the sense of my movement on stage, because I had always said that I was waiting for Pina Bausch to call me. For 30 years, I was waiting for Pina Bausch to call me to say, come on over and like, you know, do something with us. And she didn't, but so John is my Pina, and in a way, he's throwing me into a whole new world where I will be performing also. And so, you know, it's terrifying and exhilarating in every way. And we're talking a lot about poetry. We're reading a lot of Baudelaire and Lydia Davis and talking
interesting
about,
combination.
Yeah, no, it's actually amazing how you can, well, what's inspiring at the time and why are those things influencing you? So we're learning a Laurel and Hardy dance that is so charming, you can't believe it. Anyway, so there are so many different elements in this. And for me, the last thing I ever want to do is act. I mean, that would be, you know, just like anathema, if that's the word of the month. And so
that should be. Let's do that. Let's use that word.
Anathema to me. So I'm hoping that we create a piece that reflects a certain kind of honesty, a certain kind of whimsy. So some kind of intersection of pathos and wit and the story of a day.
And will you be a principal dancer in the ballet?
I will be a principal. Without principles, I will be a performer. I won't say dancer. I'll say, as they say, movement practitioner, though that sounds too clinical. I will be one of the performers for sure, unless he fires me. And you never know.
Let's talk about your collaboration with Rick Meyerowitz. You have created together the famous New Yorker cover, New Yorkistan. So can you explain what that cover is?
It was in response to 9/11 and the trauma and the tragedy that everybody felt. And we started talking about what all of these tribes and how nobody knew what was going on. And then we started talking about New York and then about the neighborhoods in New York. And so it's a spoof in a way of a tribal city. New York is broken up into different neighborhoods, like the Mullahs in Wall Street and the Easy Pashtuns for Easy Pass and Pashminas for the Upper East Side. You know, but working with Rick is actually an incredibly powerful relationship because we're great friends and we can be incredibly hurtful with each other, a.k.a. honest with each other. And we both have a love of language and playing with words. And so we after that, we did the subway, the New York City subway map, where we took all the words off and put food instead of every stop. And every single word on the map was a food reference. And
you've done a lot of op-eds, a lot of arts for the New York Times as well.
We just did a piece on New Year's Day on the state we're in. So the ongoing interest, he's curious about a million different things, and so that's wonderful. And he's curious about things that I'm not interested in. He tells me about politics, and I wish he wouldn't, but he does. And so there's a really nice balance of interests. So it's funny and fun.
You've also collaborated with your son.
This is true. Alex Kelman.
And it's so interesting because it's not only a collaboration with your son, but it's also a collaboration with your mother.
I know.
So can you describe what you did with Alex and with Sarah?
So Alex Kelman, my son, is the director of the smallest museum in New York and perhaps in the world, in an elevator shaft on Cortland Alley. And it's called Museum. It's really a hole in the wall on a shoestring budget. And he's curated installations that reflect our life in the kind of anthropological design, vernacular, social commentary world, with a sense of humor. And then he had another little space that opened up down the alley. And when my mother died, I wanted to open a museum of her closet in her apartment on Horatio Street, but that didn't work out. So we kept all of her things. And 11 years later, he and I created an installation that's on this alley. It looks like a diorama in the Museum of Natural History with a glass front and a light bulb. And she wore only white. So it's a very graphic and stunningly beautiful, organized, neat is a pin closet. And so that's what we worked on together and created Sarah Berman's closet.
And is it still on exhibit now?
It's not on exhibit now, but it's going to another place. It's going to the Met.
Tell us about that, Myra Kelman.
So if all goes well and they don't change their minds in the middle of the night, it's going to go to the American wing of the Metropolitan Museum as an installation, as a counterpoint to the lavish and extravagant dressing rooms and furniture of the wealthy. So this is one woman who didn't have any money, who came from Belarus, in her apartment in Horatio Street, and how that life is also important and that should be also in a museum and celebrated.
And I believe that the Met is one of your favorite places on earth. You think
it
that
is.
It's a sublime museum.
The Met is the best place on earth.
And you go there all the time.
No, I'm there, once a week for sure.
And so it feels, again, this word that seems to come up a lot when thinking about Myra Kelman, really serendipitous that the closet should end up in this place that's become your second home in many ways.
I know. It's so many full circles that I don't even know what to
do. I know. It's like a spirograph.
Yes, but I'm immensely grateful. I'm truly.
The last thing I want to ask you about are your Buddha shoes. Mm-hmm. I know that they're a bit too big. Talk about why you have these shoes and what they mean to you.
Well, I was in England at Sissinghurst, which is Vita Sackville West's incredible home and the incredible gardens. And nearby, this is in Kent in England, and it's central casting, beautiful there. And so I went to a little village and I went to the thrift shop and bought these perfect brown shoes, Oxfords, that were a little bit too big for me. But they were too perfect to turn down, so they're probably like two sizes too big. And so I started wearing them, looking like one of those people that you look at on the street saying, oh, my God, I hope I don't end up that way. And it made me walk really slowly.
Mm.
So I spend a lot of time walking, and of course, and I'm observing all the time, but this is really pushing it to an extreme. So I said those are, my being in the moment, very much in the moment. Otherwise, you're going to fall on your face, shoes.
Before I let you leave, Myra, I want to quote a quote. This is the first time I'd ever read this particular quote, and you referred to it in an interview, and it's a quote by Einstein. And I think that it so perfectly sums up what you do for the world. The only reason for time is so that everything does not happen at once. You never know when a truly significant, funny, or moving moment might suddenly appear, or how they later appear in an illustration or a painting or a story. So thank you for all of your beautiful, life-affirming, illustrations and paintings and stories, Myra Kelman.
Thank you very much. It's very sweet of you.
For more information about Myra Kelman and all of her magnificent work, head on over to her website, myrakelman.com. This is the 11th anniversary of Design Matters. I'd like to thank you for listening. And remember, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, or we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Design Matters with Debbie Millman is recorded at the Masters in Branding Studio at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. It is produced by Curtis Fox Productions with technical assistance by Mark Dudlick. The show is published exclusively by DesignObserver.com. You can subscribe to this free podcast in the iTunes Store.
You're growing a business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate, no coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.